Greetings, fellow sect members. This is Lisa from Edinburgh, and you are listening to episode 59 of Underwood and Flinch Underground.
Time for...
Hello, patrons, and welcome, finally, to Underwood and Flinch Underground, episode 59. My sincere apologies for the delay on this one, but... as I said in my post at the end of November, you know, the episode just wasn't ready to go at that time. The reason why really came down to some 2,000 words or so that were just not working for me. They weren't doing what they were supposed to do, you know, that being, obviously, to tell the story coherently. And that word, coherently, is the crux of it, and the thing that ultimately led to those 2,000 words being cut. Yes, sometimes just cutting the mangled and gangrenous limb off is the simplest thing of all, no matter how much you're attached to it. Kill your darlings, that's what they say, you know, in sort of writing classes and whatnot. Not that I've ever been to a writing class, but I've heard that said. Anyway, I'll talk to you about, you know, the whole thing a bit more on the other side of the, you know, the story content, because I'm sure after so long a wait, you're rather keen for me to just shut up and get on with episode 59. But before I can do that, I will just have to do some quick recapping for you, unless you've got a phenomenal memory. So, this episode then follows on directly from the last one, in which Claire Redmond ended up in the clutches of Underwood and Flinch. You may recall that Underwood knocked her out because she had resisted his attempt at fascination of her, and then David picked her up and insisted on carrying her with him down to Rose's subterranean apartment because he thought two things. One, the people who had just shot her, specifically Coleridge, supported by a gang of tactical assault-type characters, probably weren't going to be very nice to her if they should leave her, you know, there for them to find. And two, she could have useful information about the enemy that is now literally right outside their front door. And this episode also requires you to have a very long memory because there's some references to things that happened earlier in the story, some of which in the story's timeline only happened about an hour ago, but in our real time happened months and months ago. So I'll have to give you a quick refresher on those points. Now, of course, if you were reading this in a book, you could just flick back through the pages and indeed the memory of it all would be much fresher. Like, for example, if you were listening to this as an audiobook, you know, one chapter after another, binge listening, as the people say these days. But anyway, sorry, I'm rabbiting. I will now give you that refresher. David mentions Ronnie Bishop, the journalist Ronnie Bishop. Mentions Ronnie referring to Coleridge having a Malleus ring on his finger. This was way back in episode 26 when David first met Ronnie in the pub opposite Holborn Station, you know, before he spotted Damo and they ran into the station and all that stuff. Ronnie, at the time, was telling him about the Malleus and what he knew / suspected about them, including the fact that they, at least used to, wear these rings on their fingers, and that a young Coleridge, who had once beaten him up in the line of duty, once wore such a ring. David then later told Underwood about that conversation when they were at his house in Bloomsbury Square, and that was back in episode 39. In that same episode, David noticed he had received some phone messages from Ronnie and called him back. In that call, Ronnie said, amongst other things, that he knew who the London vampire was. Then, following that, in episode 40, when Underwood and Flinch went directly around to Ronnie's flat, they found him dead in a murder that was dressed up to look like a suicide. So, once they'd finished there, they went straight round to Surrey Street, which is, of course, where they are now, although it's a bit later on. And now, they are descending in the lift along with the unconscious Claire Redmond and Elizabeth Daventry to the pantry, you know, where they keep the three women to snack on, that being the last stated destination of Damo and Rose. So, all that said then, let's get there ahead of them, shall we? As we finally move out of the shadows and into...
Underwood and Flinch, Underground, a novel written and performed for podcast by Mike Bennett. This podcast is intended for an adult audience. Episode 59. Rose was feeding on Louise. The young woman was sprawled beneath her on the damp-smelling sofa in the room they referred to as the living room of the pantry. Seated at the other end of the sofa, her legs curled beneath her, was Karen, who drew and twirled strands of her hair absently as she watched Rose feed. The pantry women had been sleeping when earlier Rose and Damo had returned from their night out. The vampires had apologized for waking them, but explained that they hadn't been able to procure prey and so would need one last bite each. And since Karen and Bernadette had already given blood earlier in the evening, it would fall to Louise to provide for both of them. Damo had fed first, with Rose watching over him to make sure he didn't take too much, and then she had taken over. Karen had watched with interest as Damo lapped saliva onto the bite, stemming the blood flow before moving aside to allow Rose to suck the wounds back into life. A woman's laugh echoed down the low-ceilinged concrete hallway that led to the bathroom. It was Bernadette, though Karen noted it wasn't her usual laugh. Normally when anyone made a joke or they were watching a comedy DVD, Bernie guffawed, a resonant ha-ha-ha that was in itself amusing for both Karen and Louise. But the laugh she heard now was tinkling, flirtatious, and intended solely for Damo. She had followed him down to the bathroom when he had gone for a pee. Bernie fancied him, of course. They all did to varying degrees, but none of them would ever actually do anything about it. It was clear that Damo was now Rose's boyfriend, and they were all very happy for her. But still, it was nice to flirt a little, and Damo certainly seemed to share. Her thoughts were interrupted by a sound from the entrance hallway. Was that a knock? Impossible. The only person who ever came to that door was Rose. But then came the unmistakable creaking of the long, unoiled hinges of the door. Karen tapped Rose on the bottom and hissed her name. With a slurping lick at Louise's neck, Rose lifted her head. What? Someone's at the...
Hello?
A man's voice called from the entrance hall. Rose's eyes darkened.
Ich glaube es nicht, she growled, wiping blood from her mouth with the back of her hand.
Rose!
The man's voice was drawing nearer. Then Karen's eyes widened as a face she had only ever seen in faded photographs entered the room. What was especially startling was the fact that though the photographs were over half a century old, the face was exactly the same. Her hand went to her mouth.
Oh my God!
Underwood paid no attention to Karen or the now stirring Louise, addressing himself directly to Rose.
Rose, I'm so sorry to come barging in again, but I'm afraid we're in a spot of trouble.
What?
Said Rose, her voice simmering with rage. Then Karen's eye was drawn by another man walking in, this one carrying a woman in his arms. His eyes widened as he looked around the room, his expression betraying his sudden horror. Or was it amazement? She couldn't decide. Then, on seeing Karen looking at him, his face took on a more friendly aspect.
Oh, all right.
What do you mean, trouble?
Rose demanded of Underwood.
Just that, I'm afraid. The law, or rather the Malleus, are outside.
Verdammte Scheiße!
She sprang up and grabbed Underwood by the lapels.
You fucking asshole! It's not enough you bring yourself to darken my door, but now you bring disaster upon me!
Upon entering the room, David had been somewhat taken aback. Underwood had told him they were going to a human pantry, and he'd been expecting to be met with a lot worse. In the lift down, he'd been imagining some kind of medieval torture dungeon, men with long grizzled beards manacled to walls in tiny cells with the scars of 1,000 bloodletting cuts covering their emaciated bodies.
By that standard, the room had come as something of a relief. However, it still came as a shock to be confronted by this strange prison, equipped as it was with what were clearly supposed to be all the comforts of home. His eyes roved over the gallery of aged pin-ups covering the walls. A young and shirtless David Hasselhoff, a Smash Hits magazine centrefold of the blonde mop-headed 80s band The Police, even a black and white, or rather black and yellow, magazine photo of a young and moody Elvis Presley. Then he noticed the floor, bare concrete with gullies converging to a point in the centre of the room covered by a rug. He intuited that a drain lay under there. So had this once been a shower room? Or, more probably, he thought, a slaughterhouse, a place where victims were bled, drained, and butchered. Had his father and other more distant ancestors been the ones wielding the cleaver? Of course they had. Wasn't that their job? He pushed the thought from his mind. In addition to Rose, there were two other women in the room, both deathly pale, undernourished, and in their sleepwear. One was lying under Rose on a red, though heavily stained, sofa with a pair of bloody holes in her neck, and the other was looking at him with a puzzled expression, no doubt due to the fact that he was carrying an unconscious and increasingly heavy Claire Redmond in his arms. He smiled and greeted her. Then, as Underwood struggled to appease the furious ex-wife now shaking him by the lapels, David continued. "Have you got a first aid kit by any chance?" He nodded down to Claire. "She's been shot." "Oh, Jesus." Karen got up. Yeah, we have it in the kitchen." She pointed to her vacated spot on the sofa. "Here, put her down here." "Thanks." David lowered Claire to the sofa and began removing her jacket.
"And what do you think you're doing?" demanded Rose.
"She's wounded," said David.
"She needs help." "Yes, she's bleeding all over my sofa."
"Oh, like you'd notice," he replied, not turning from where he now unbuttoned Claire's shirt. Then he heard Damo's voice.
"Hey! What's going on?"
David turned to see Damo, still in his filthy summer dress and flip-flops, and a third sickly-looking woman standing in a doorway on the other side of the room.
"Underwood has brought the Malleus upon us," said Rose.
Damo frowned.
"The what?"
"They're a sort of SWAT team," said David. "Anti-vampire troops, outside, at least a dozen of them."
"Anti-vampire? You mean like they're going to kill us?"
"Yes, that's a general idea," said Underwood. "So you might want to put some sensible shoes on."
"Fucking hell! What are we going to do?"
"Well, I propose we take the train tunnel," said Underwood. "They almost certainly think this place goes no deeper than the basement level, and there's absolutely no way they'd know it connects to the underground."
"What about the roof? We could fly out of here. Bring Dave and your one with us."
He nodded to Elizabeth Daventry, who stood nervously watching proceedings from the doorway of the entrance passage.
"Now, they've got a helicopter," said Underwood.
"And if they've brought that, it's precisely to prevent our escaping that way.
Flinch, I would imagine that by now helicopters have machine guns in them. Is that correct?"
"Oh, yes," said David, peeling Claire's shirt away from her wound. "And a lot worse than that." He was relieved to see the bullet had only grazed her, but it needed dressing. He looked up, glanced around the room, and called out,
"Any sign of that first aid kit?"
"I'm looking,"
Karen called back from the kitchen. Underwood peered over David's shoulder at Claire's wound.
"Oh, it's only a scratch, Flinch. Here."
He eased David to one side and leant towards Claire.
"Hey," said David, "what are you doing?"
In reply, Underwood made a throaty sound and drew saliva into his mouth. He then lowered himself to Claire's wound. Then Rose, spotting the ring on the chain around Claire's neck, pointed and declared,
"She's Malleus."
"Yeah, we know," said David.
"You know? And you're helping her? Daniel, you should be tearing her throat out, not kissing it better."
Underwood lifted his face and licked his lips.
"There you are, Flinch. She'll be right as rain in no time."
"Daniel!"
exclaimed Rose.
"It's all right, Rose. The Malleus are actually the ones who shot her. She's a police inspector. Flinchy here thinks she could be useful to us, wants me to fascinate her and see if she knows what they're up to."
"You mean you haven't done this already?"
Well, no, I've been rather busy dodging bullets and bringing you up to speed, haven't I?
Oh, I do it.
Rose directed a kick to David's bottom where he knelt over Claire.
Move aside, Flinch.
At that point, Karen returned with the first aid kit.
I found it.
David reached to take it from her, and Rose pushed him out of her way. She ignored his protests and seized Claire by the chin, turning her face to hers and shaking Claire's head.
Wake up! Come on! You're probably not even unconscious!
Claire, who actually was unconscious, began to come round. She opened her eyes to see a fierce-looking woman with a bloody mouth glaring at her. She flinched away, diverting her eyes from what she knew had to be another vampire.
Oh, no, you don't, missy.
Rose twisted Claire's face back to hers.
Open your eyes, damn it! Open them or I'd cut off your fucking eyelids!
Hey, Rose, calm down, love, said Damo. She's frightened for fuck's sake. Look, can't we just try asking her what's going on before we start cutting bits off her?
We don't have time for the pleasantries, Damien. You know nothing of the Malleus. This woman is our enemy.
I'm not with the Malleus, said Claire, her eyes tightly shut.
She had Rose's arm in both her hands and was trying to break her grip on her, but the arm was as rigid as steel.
Then why do you wear their ring around your neck? Demanded Rose.
It was my dad's. It's just a family heirloom.
So your father was Malleus?
Yes, but I only found that out today. The man who told me is the same one who just shot me outside.
What? Why did he do that?
Because I was trying to arrest him.
Rose frowned. She looked at Underwood.
Is this so?
Underwood shrugged. Yes, an older chap. To Claire, he said.
So why were you trying to arrest him?
Because he tried to kill me, Claire managed to say, despite Rose's fingers pressing deep into the flesh of her cheeks. He sent a vampire to do it.
What?
Underwood almost laughed.
Oh, and I suppose this was the London vampire, was it?
Yes, a man, or rather a thing, called Miguel.
Miguel?
Underwood turned to David and Damo with raised eyebrows.
I told you it had to be someone else from Spain, said Damo to David. I should have put money on it.
Yes, as did I, said Underwood.
But you did not, said David. You said it was him.
He cocked a thumb over his shoulder to Damo.
Well, yes, but I also allowed for the possibility of it being someone else from Spain. And anyway, the pair of you thought it was me.
Shut up, all of you, said Rose. It doesn't matter who said what. What matters is who is outside now and what they are going to do. So you,
she shook Claire's chin again.
Tell me.
Tell you what? Said Claire, her eyes still closed.
They're Malleus. You already know that.
Why are they here? What do they want?
They're here for Underwood, Lord Daniel Underwood.
I knew it,
said Rose, turning to Underwood angrily.
It is you they want. You should give yourself up, and then they will go away.
Oh, thank you, Rose. Throw me to the wolves, why don't you?
Rose shook Claire again.
Do they know of me? Of us?
I don't know. I don't know who you are, who any of you are.
Oh, then we are safe.
Rose turned back to Underwood.
Go on, get out. Do the honourable thing. Or are you one of the cads, the pounders?
I think you mean bounders, said Underwood.
I mean cowards, damn you. Go, you can still save us from this mess of yours if you act now.
Oh, yes, and of course they won't come in here and search the place, will they? They'd have no curiosity whatsoever about what we're doing here or what this place might be to us. They'd just toddle off without bothering to even peek inside the...
A slap across the face cut him off.
Don't be a fucking smartass, said Rose. You have no remorse, do you? For this, for deserting me, for anything.
Underwood touched his cheek and felt the rising heat. He struggled for a response, some quick and pithy retort, but he found himself lost for words as, for the first time that night, he recognized in Rose's expression not anger, not rage, but pain. Earlier she had wanted to admonish him, to punish him, to show him that despite all he had done to her, she was still strong, that she neither needed him nor wanted him. She had her home, her life, a new lover, and a new beginning. But now, by his doing this, by bringing the enemy here to her door, he had taken even that from her. An apology would ring hollow, because, until now, that's what all his apologies had been. He lowered his eyes. David knew that despite the fact that Underwood was right, that his going outside would save none of them, there was now a chance he might try to do the honourable thing and surrender himself anyway. He also knew that if he intervened in the conversation in Underwood's defence, it would only make matters worse. Instead, he turned to Claire and said, "So what about Miguel, the guy who came to kill you? What happened to him?"
"He's dead."
That drew Underwood's attention.
"Dead? Are you sure?"
"Yes, I shot him."
"Well," he scoffed, "that won't do it. You'd have to try harder than that."
"In the head and the heart. Trust me, he's dead."
Underwood was surprised, but only for a moment.
"Really? And how exactly did you know to do that if you're not Malleus?"
"I'm not Malleus. I didn't even know what that was until earlier today."
"She's lying."
Rose tightened her grip, her fingernails biting into the flesh of Claire's face. Claire, whose eyes were still closed, knew whereabouts her various inquisitors were in the room by the sound of their voices. She looked to where David was and opened her eyes.
"Please, I can't speak like this. I can't talk."
David laid a hand on Rose's arm.
"Look, can you just let her go, your ladyship? It's not like she's going to go anywhere."
"Oh, and so now the servants are giving the masters the orders?"
She looked at Underwood.
"Are you going to stand for this?"
"Actually, he's his own man now, Rose," said Underwood. "I released him from my service just this evening. Long story."
"Look, she can't answer the questions with your fingers sunk in her face, your ladyship," said David. "Please."
With a huff of contempt, Rose released her grip on Claire.
"All right, but I don't trust her."
Underwood resumed his questioning.
"Now, Inspector, you were telling us how it was that you knew where to shoot Miguel."
"I didn't know," she lied. "I shot him several times, but those were the ones that stopped him."
"Is that so? So, just dumb luck?"
"Dumb luck and firearms training. I mean, if you want to kill something, anything, that's where you shoot it, isn't it?"
Underwood considered, not just her reply, but her demeanour. She was afraid, and quite rightly, but she was able to retain her composure. He liked that. He nodded.
"Yes, I suppose it is."
David moved into the space vacated by Rose and showed Claire the first aid kit.
"I'm just going to fix up your arm, okay?"
Claire had forgotten about her injury. She looked at it and was amazed to see that the wound, a gaping gash just below the shoulder of her left arm, had, though it was still open, stopped bleeding.
How did you do that?"
"He didn't," said Underwood.
"I did."
"Don't worry about it,"
said David, swabbing the still bloody area with cotton wool dabbed with antiseptic. "The important thing is the bullet only grazed you." Claire, also now realising she was in a state of partial undress, pulled her shirt closed over her chest as best she could.
"Rose," said Bernadette, "does this mean we have to leave?"
Rose glared at Underwood, then nodded.
"I'm afraid so, Bernadette. You, Louise, and Karen should get dressed quickly. You too, Damien, unless you want to leave here looking like that."
Excuse me, Rose," said Underwood, "but why do these women need to come? They're just food. You can leave them here and they'll be perfectly fine. The Malleus won't hurt them. They're victims, after all."
"They are not just food," shouted Rose. "They are my friends. Just as you have your Flinch, I have them, and they are no less important to me than he and his godforsaken forebears are to you."
Underwood held up his hands.
All right, I'm sorry. I didn't realise. I apologise."
He glanced around, taking in the eyes of the pantry women and Damo as he added,
"But you'd better be quick about it. They could be in through that door any minute."
As the women exited, followed by Damo, Underwood turned to Claire.
"Actually, Inspector, what do you think's holding them up? Could it be that you're in here with us?"
Massaging her jaw, and with eyes downcast, Claire replied,
"I don't know. I came in here before they were in position. They could be doing that now, covering all the exits, or maybe they're just waiting for the order to move in."
"Perhaps they're waiting for a warrant to be approved,"
said Elizabeth, pleased to offer a legal perspective, before wondering aloud, That is, if they need warrants under vampire circumstances like these. I don't know. It's nothing I've ever had to deal with.
It might turn into a siege, said David.
I doubt it, said Claire. They shot me. I'm not exactly a valued hostage.
Hmm, said Underwood thoughtfully. Not you, perhaps, but Flinch has an interesting idea.
Flinch? Claire looked at the man dressing her wound. So this must be David Flinch, a name Miguel had mentioned in his conversation with Mackay in reference to a vampire killing in Brighton. Then Underwood was speaking again.
About this hostage idea, Rose. What if one of your lady friends were to make an appearance on the steps outside at the end of a rope and then tell them that she was a hostage? She could tell them...
No,
said Rose flatly.
But it could gain us so much time.
I said no. They stay with me, and that is final. Why don't you throw your Flinch outside at the end of a rope? I told you what he is to you, they are to me.
Because he's not a credible hostage, is he? They've just seen him strolling out of here with me. So bring him with you down to the station. I have no problem with him or your other companion.
Rose nodded to Elizabeth.
And you shall have none with mine. So there is no need for further debate.
Underwood sighed. He noticed a packet of cigarettes and a lighter on the coffee table. He picked them up and lit one, then turned back to Claire.
So this man outside, the chap who shot you and sent Miguel to do you in, who is he?
Claire, who no longer felt a shred of allegiance to Coleridge, replied, Detective Chief Superintendent Coleridge of the Occult Crimes Unit.
Coleridge?
David looked up at the name and turned back to Underwood.
Why, it's got to be the same guy who Ronnie was talking about, the one he suspected had a Malleus ring.
Underwood recalled what David had told him about the dead journalist in his brush with a suspected Malleus policeman in the 80s. He nodded, but continued to address Claire.
The OCU? They're still this country's arm of the Malleus, are they?
Claire nodded.
That's what I understand. So since when have the Malleus been using vampires as assassins? They're supposed to kill them, not employ them.
I don't know. All I know is that the coppers out there, the OCU officers, they're not the good guys anymore. They're all working for some master vampire called Volkman.
At the mention of the name, Underwood recoiled slightly.
What? Who did you say?
Claire, who continued to look down while David secured the dressing on her arm, didn't see his reaction. She replied,
Volkman.
Coleridge told me his name was Heinrich Volkman. Rose saw the perplexity on Underwood's face.
Do you know this man, Daniel?
Yes. Yes, you could say that.
But I thought he was dead.
David, his back to Underwood, chuckled.
Well, that seems to be a pretty common status among you vampires, my lord. Is there any among you who isn't currently thought to be dead?
Underwood ignored him and spoke to Claire.
Did Coleridge tell you anything else about Volkman?
David finished up bandaging Claire's arm, and she pulled her shirt back into position.
Not much, but he told me he was involved in the death of my dad. He said Volkman wasn't directly responsible for it, but I'll reserve judgment on that till I'm in possession of all the facts.
I see. Spoken like a true copper. So when was this, the death of your father?
1983.
Then Damo walked back into the room, wearing one of Underwood's black suits, minus tie.
Hey, how do we look? Reservoir Dogs, right? Mr. Feckin' Black.
Underwood raised an eyebrow.
Yes, you may borrow my clothes, Damo. Thank you for asking.
Why, sorry, your lordship, but it was either this or one of Rose's frocks. I don't really have the legs for that, as you know.
Indeed. Are those women ready yet?
I dunno. Women getting dressed?
He shrugged.
How long is a piece of string?
Jesus, even in the event of an impending police raid, they can't just throw something on, can they?
He saw Rose glowering at him and held up a hand.
Which is fair enough, given that this is all my fault. I go and help them, said Rose. I need to gather a few things myself, now that I think of it. Don't worry, we'll be back in a minute, and then we go.
Underwood held his tongue until she had left, then began pacing.
So, Heinrich Volkman.
He shook his head in wonder.
That old bastard.
Who is he, my lord? Asked David.
Oh, not now, Flinch. Assuming his people don't kill us, I'll tell you later.
What I want to know is how his gang of OCU thugs managed to catch up with us. I mean, it's not like we left a trail of dead bodies in our wake, is it?
Well, David began, but Underwood cut him off.
Not in general, Flinch. I mean since leaving my house in Bloomsbury Square.
Well, even then, you've got Ronnie, my lord.
The journalist? I didn't kill him. He's nothing to do with me. But we were still there.
Claire, realising that the Ronnie they were referring to was a journalist, looked up.
Ronnie? Do you mean Ronnie Bishop?
Yeah, said David.
Do you know him?
Only on a professional level. Are you saying he's dead?
Yeah. We found his body about an hour ago. He was murdered, but the killer was trying to make it look like suicide. His lordship reckons it was a vampire that did it.
Claire's curiosity overcame her wariness of Underwood's gaze. She turned to him and asked,
"Why do you think that?"
Underwood smiled.
"Because, amongst other things, the killer jumped from a 40-foot-high window."
"Did you see him jump?"
"No, but I saw his footprints embedded in the lawn where he landed."
"Ronnie reckoned he knew who the London vampire was," said David. "So we think that's why the vampire killed him. He was writing it all up for tomorrow's paper when he was murdered."
Elizabeth added, "The vampire also stole the laptop Bishop was working on, along with his camera. Presumably there was evidence on both."
A laptop and camera? Claire recalled when she had arrived at Surrey Street earlier. Coleridge's car. The bonnet still warm. Her peering into the dark interior to see a laptop and a small digital camera on the passenger seat.
There was a laptop and a camera in Coleridge's car.
What? Said David.
When? Just now, outside. It might be a coincidence, but he did tell me he'd tracked you down here, so if you came directly from Ronnie Bishop's.
You mean he followed us? Said Underwood.
He looked at Elizabeth.
Did you see anyone on our tail?
No, said Elizabeth. I mean, I don't think so, but I confess I was rather distracted by what had just happened at Bishop's flat, and then by what you and Mr. Flinch were saying in the car.
Are you saying you weren't paying attention?
Well, no, I was, but only in a normal driver fashion, you know, mirror signal manoeuvre and so on.
Damn it, Underwood hissed. So, yes then. Coleridge must have followed us here from Bishop's. But what was he doing there?
Killing Ronnie? Said David.
No, Underwood shook his head.
Bishop was killed by a vampire. Unless, of course, Chief Superintendent Coleridge happens to be a vampire. Is he, Inspector?
What? Said Claire.
Coleridge, a vampire?
Yes. Have you noticed any telltale signs? Always working the night shift, skipping meals due to a preference for a flask of what he claims is homemade tomato soup?
No, no, he's as human as you, or...
Realising the phrase didn't work with Underwood, she looked from him, to David, to Damo, to Elizabeth.
Actually, which of you, if any, are human?
Me and her, said David, nodding to Elizabeth.
Well, then... He's as human as me or either of you.
Of course he is, said Underwood. So it can't have been him that killed Bishop.
Well then who did? Said David.
At that moment, Rose and the pantry women walked into the room, all now dressed and each carrying an item of luggage. The women had holdalls, but Rose carried a large suitcase. Going by the effortless manner in which she handled it, Claire assumed it must be empty. But when it bumped against the coffee table and almost knocked it over, she knew otherwise. Underwood looked at the bags in astonishment.
Rose, you can't be serious.
What?
The bags.
What about them?
Rose, we are going to have to lead these people down an underground train tunnel in the pitch dark, possibly with Malleus commandos chasing after us. They can't possibly... I mean, do you really need luggage?
Since, thanks to you, we will almost certainly never be able to return to this place, my home, ever again, then yes, I have to bring luggage. She pushed past him.
Come on, let's go.
But really, Underwood persisted, these women can't go stumbling through the dark carrying all that.
Look, just leave them. I'll buy you new things, better things.
He waved a hand to include the other women.
And that goes for all of you, too.
We aren't going to go stumbling through the dark, said Rose.
I have a train.
You what?
I have a train. Come on.
She exited into the front door passage, the women filing out after her. Underwood turned to Damo, incredulous.
A train?
That's true,
Damo nodded. She does.
Oh.
Underwood took a moment to digest the news, then, with a small shrug, said,
Oh, well, that's handy then.
He turned to Claire.
Right then, Inspector, I know you don't like the idea, but I really do need to erase some memories of yours.
Claire had lost her mind once to a vampire. She had an absolute terror of doing so again. She turned her face sharply away.
You don't have to do that. I won't tell them anything.
Yes, I'm sure you may think that, but you won't have any choice. They've clearly got vampires working for them, so once they've got you, they'll have you fascinated, and that will be that.
Please, she stepped back. My lord.
No, no, come along now. It's either that or I'll have to kill you.
Claire turned to David, her face desperate.
Please, please don't let him do that to me. Please.
Despite the risk involved in taking her with them, she was, after all, a police officer. David abhorred the idea of leaving Redmond at the mercy of people who had tried repeatedly to kill her.
Do we have to, my lord? I mean, she still has information. She could...
Then, from outside, someone shouted Underwood's name. A woman, her voice urgent, alarmed.
That was Rose, said Damo.
Then, running footsteps sounded in the hall, and Elizabeth appeared in the doorway.
My lord, there was a loud bang from somewhere up above. We heard it down the lift shaft.
A flashbang, said Claire.
A what?
Said Underwood.
A stun grenade. It means they're inside.
Damn,
said Underwood.
Roy, let's get the fuck out of here, said Damo.
Agreed. Come on.
But my lord,
David pointed to Claire.
What about her? We can't just...
Oh, for God's sake, Flinch, bring her. But she's your responsibility. If she tries any funny business, I'll rip her head off and hit you with it.
He followed Damo and Elizabeth out the door. David extended a hand to the door. After you, then, Inspector. And please, for both our sakes, no funny business, eh?
And so, with a flash and a bang, the Malleus are inside, and Underwood and Flinch, along with their friends and hostage, flee deeper underground to the last stop on the elevator. Episode 60 of Underwood and Flinch Underground.
The music you're listening to is Ahmad Armor by Fareed Farjad, courtesy of Taraneh Records and our good friend Fawaz Al-Maloud. You can find the track on Spotify and, you know, everywhere else that you can find music, basically. And so, yes, there it was, my friends, episode 59, 2,000 words lighter than it was at the end of November. So, what happened? Why did it all go wrong? Well, it just does sometimes. The problem is that these characters are, you know, in my head, they're real people. They walk around, they react to signs and signals, they think, they speak, and they react to what gets said to them. And so when, in the last third of that episode, when Underwood and Flinch began to talk about what was going on with Claire Redmond for the first time, things started to come out, things that they mutually knew. They said this, she said that, they reacted and they said something that made her say something else and so on. And this was something that I didn't try to curtail because, as I say, it's what they were doing and I wanted to follow what they were doing and saying to its conclusion because, of course, if it was good, then I would keep it in. That would become the meat of the episode. But the problem was that right now, at this juncture in the story, these characters, though they know a lot between them, are not in possession of all the facts yet. So all they were doing was speculating, hypothesizing, and never coming to a definitive correct conclusion. Now, it wasn't that kind of moment in the detective novel or movie where someone like Hercule Poirot says, aha, it was, you know, Colonel Mustard in the dining room with the candlestick, because, as I say, they didn't have all the facts, and so we couldn't come to that moment. And so
they were just batting the thing about back and forth. And as I say, never came to a definitive correct conclusion. But anyway, I didn't mind this so much because I felt, as I say, that it was what they would have said and done. And so it was organic, man. But when my wife read it, she said she found it confusing. So I explained everything to her and she understood. But of course, you know, the writing has to do that by itself, doesn't it? If it doesn't explain itself, if it isn't clear, then it is basically just bad writing. So all this was happening as we were coming up to the deadline for episode 59. So I was a bit panicked. I went away. I rewrote it, trying to clarify things by, you know, not by chopping things out, but by juggling them around a bit, shifting those 2,000 words this way and that to try and make the same ideas work. But on showing the revision to Pauline, she said, yeah, it's clearer, but it's still going to be confusing for people. So a third time I went away, tail between my legs, and stripped it down to its bare essentials. Let's look, I said to myself, let's look at what needs to happen. Blend it with what would organically happen and then just chop off all the other stuff. The speculation, the hypothesis, and then let's just see what we're left with. I wrote the whole scene again, steering them away from the fork in the road that would lead to their over-hypothesizing, and then bringing in the end action with the ladies coming back from packing in sooner. Chop. 2,000 words hit the mat. But I did happily have my final scene tidied up, and believe me, so much better than it was at the end of the original versions back in November. Of course, some writers have editors to do this, but I don't. I do all my own stunts, ladies and gentlemen. I walk this creative tightrope without a safety net. All I have is Pauline, who reads episodes before I record them and lets me know if she likes them or not. And fortunately, 99% of the time she does, and that's it. I have considered getting an editor before, but, you know, I'd have to pay them to wade through the entire Underwood and Flinch saga before they, you know, they even get to where I am now. So what, you may say? Well, I'll tell you what. I remember being approached by an editor. This was towards the end of the writing of the original Underwood and Flinch novel/podcast, because she was interested in, you know, being the editor on the work. And I said, all right, so how much would that cost? And she said, oh, a book the size of Underwood and Flinch? That'd be a grand. A grand? Ooh, no, thank you, madam. So the whole saga thus far, then, is untouched by an editor. And though I've no doubt that they could make the book, indeed all of the books, better, it would have to make, like, you know, $3,000's worth of book sales to make it worthwhile me doing it. And then I would have to re-record the whole podcast all over again to match the new editions. And, oh, God, you can see the predicament. But anyway, that's the state of play in that department. Of course, when, or if, I should say, the television programme gets made, then I will have the money to play around with that kind of thing. But for now, at least, I'll just keep on rocking as I have done these last 13 years. Actually, it's about 20 years now since I first started writing those original Hall of Mirrors stories. That was way back in 1999. And I think at the time I was working as a porter at the Norfolk Hotel in Brighton. Horrible job. Terrible, terrible place. Long story. Actually, there was a chef there who wasn't a very nice man. And he always used to say to me, yeah, I've got my eye on you. You're a wrong boy, aren't you? You're a wrong boy. And I said, I'm not a wrong boy, whatever a wrong boy is. But he wouldn't be told. Anyway, he ended up, you know, or at least his line did, ended up in one of the Hall of Mirrors stories, which you probably know if you're a complete nerd for my work. But if you're not, I'll give you the answer to that quiz question. That line appeared in The Grave. Do you remember there were the two guys in The Grave and one of them said, oh, I've got my eye on you. You're a wrong boy, aren't you? That's where he came from, chef at the Norfolk Hotel. Anyway, blah, 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 blah. Sorry, I went off on one there. Anyway, that all brings us to the end of this podcast, my friends. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your patronage. And especially this month, thank you also for your patience and understanding, you know, for the time that it has taken me to get this episode right.
I can now begin work on episode 60, which is still the planned final episode, and as promised in my post at the end of November, it will be out this month before New Year's Eve. Pressure? Oh no, no pressure. I've just got to tie up the loose ends of 58 chapters, plus two previous volumes in the saga, and make the whole thing flow seamlessly into the next volume in that saga. No pressure at all. Though I will say, I really do have to get cracking on it. So, from me for now then, ladies and gentlemen, until the moon rises again over Underwood and Flinch, farewell.
Mike Bennett, author.com.